Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a call by the Kremlin to respect the will of the people in a secessionist referendum in eastern Ukraine that Russian President Putin claimed to oppose. Matthew Rojanski, the director of the Kennan Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center, joins us to discuss how much Putin is in control of events in Ukraine or is winging it, and the extent to which the U.S. is continually playing catch-up with a regime in Russia that is a unique geopolitical hybrid of organized crime and national security, the mafia and nuclear weapons. Then we'll examine the latest leaks about what the Federal Communication Commission might be proposing in terms of the future of net neutrality ahead of Thursday's vote on allowing public comment on new rules by the FCC. Sarah Morris, Senior Policy Counsel for the Open Technology Institute at the New America Foundation, joins us to discuss the new rules circulated today that will open up FCC plans for the future of the Internet to public comment, and the extent to which the FCC chairman, who has already received a blizzard of outrage over plans to allow fast lanes for content companies willing to spend payola to have internet service providers fast-track their content, will bend to the public's will over the lobbying power of the cable and telecom oligopolies. Then finally, we will speak with Brant Olson, the campaign director at Forecast the Facts, a grassroots community organization which, along with other public interest groups, is joining in demonstrations today at Google's annual shareholders meeting. We will discuss concerns that the company that avows the motto, "Don't be evil," is not providing transparency about its lobbying efforts and its membership of the Chamber of Commerce and ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, that is actively engaged in trying to kill solar power, which Google is underwriting. And joining us now is Matthew Rojanski, who is the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova. He has advised governments, intergovernmental organizations on conflict resolution and efforts to enhance shared security throughout the Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian region. Previously, he was deputy director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he founded Carnegie's Ukraine program. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Rojanski.
Thank you, Ian. Happy to be with you.
And President Putin seems to have been engaged in a bit of kabuki theater about these elections or these secessionist referendums in the east of Ukraine, calling for them to postpone them or not to put them on at the same time, clearly now saying it's the will of the people. Do you think that Putin is winging it, or does he have some incredible master plan here? Because my understanding is if you use Mao Zedong's old dictum that it's better to have hegemony without responsibility, why would you want to end up with owning a deadbeat province like Donetsk?
Well, I think, first of all, Donetsk is a prize in and of itself. It is far beyond a deadbeat. It's actually one of the economic engines of Ukraine. Certainly the Donbass industrial region, which includes both Donetsk and Luhansk. But it also speaks to the larger prize here, which is the prize of Ukraine itself. And so in answer to your earlier question, I think it's a mixture of the two. I think that on the one hand, Putin is thinking strategically to a degree much more so than many others. Certainly many in the West have been able to do. We've been very reactive in the West. We have been on our heels basically since the crisis began, whereas I think Putin is thinking several moves ahead. But I think at the same time, he has to be opportunistic. He has to see how things develop on the ground. If it turns out, for example, that the referendum is able to begin momentum, which results in a critical mass of local citizens actually following through on the message of the organizers and really pushing away from the government in Kiev, well, then he has an entirely different situation on his hands. He doesn't have to manufacture anything. He can just ride that wave to de facto separation and perhaps annexation by Russia. On the other hand, if the majority, as the reliable polls have indicated thus far, continue to say that they want to stay in Ukraine, that they want to remain in a united Ukraine, that they oppose separation and independence, they oppose Russian intervention, you know, invading at that point would be a nightmare for Russia. It would destroy Putin's resurgent popularity at home, and it would be worse than the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan 30 years ago. And I think he's not that stupid. In that case, he would play the long-term game and try to have a hand in the shape of the new Ukrainian political order.
Well, it's pretty clear that he's either doesn't want to have these elections on May the 25th to take place or do everything he can to frustrate them. And it would seem now that if, based upon what the leaders of these self-declared autonomous republics who have put on this referendum, which the Kiev government refers to as a farce, they are now saying that they will not participate in the May 25th election. So that seems to be the strategy as far as I can see.
First of all, I'm not entirely sure that Putin is as opposed to this presidential election as he once was, for two reasons. First of all, he has come out and said, let's give the presidential election a chance. This is not a guy. He may have practiced deception. He may be using Kremlin media mouthpieces to mislead people, including the international community. But this is, by and large, a guy that, for his own domestic political reasons, tends not to say one thing and then take it back. There have been exceptions to that, but that's generally not his modus operandi. But second, and this is entirely speculative, but I think that the circumstantial evidence bears it out, I think he has to have cut a deal by now with the heir apparent to the Ukrainian presidency, Petro Poroshenko. The reason is Poroshenko, as of 2 weeks ago, was so far ahead in the polls that it became clear he would probably win in a first round, regardless of the level of participation in the election. He would win so dominantly in the West and in the center that no amount of opposition from the East could throw the election to Tymoshenko or to anyone else. What that meant was, for Poroshenko, he was about to inherit a country which was on the brink of disaster, which is about to be invaded by Russia, about to be dismembered. From Putin's perspective, it meant he couldn't control the outcome of the election. And if he can't stop the election from taking place in the first place, then he'd better have some scenario for the day after where he can actually deal with the guy who wins. And I think it's almost inevitable. Poroshenko has factories in Russia. He has good contacts that go all the way to the Kremlin. I think he has to have cut some kind of deal, and that's why Putin came out and said, yeah, go ahead and let the presidential election go.
And would that explain why the Party of Regions is apparently putting up candidates? So they're not boycotting the election in the East?
Well, I think there's going to be plenty of kind of, if you want to cherry pick your evidence that the election is legitimate because it has participation from the East, there'll be plenty of isolated evidence, evidentiary clumps that you can draw from. And one of those is participation by Regions Party candidates. Another will be that there will be voting in the East. I'm sure there will even be voting in Donetsk and Luhansk. After all, the separatist authorities do not control those provinces in their entirety. So it'll be just a question of numbers, and just as the separatist referendum organizers are doing now, a case can be made that, you know, there was enough of a plurality, a critical mass of people, that it's a legitimate vote. And as I say, I expect the victory by Poroshenko to be a large enough margin that it wouldn't have mattered anyway, that you know, 1 or 2 million votes one way or another from the East would not have changed the outcome.
Again, I'm speaking with Matthew Rajansky, who's the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. He's an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova, and he's advised governments, intergovernmental organizations on conflict resolution and efforts to enhance shared security throughout the Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian region. Previously, he was deputy director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he founded Carnegie's Ukraine program. So my understanding is that on the ground in the East, most of the people in the middle just don't want all this strife. And it's basically being driven by the two poles on the East. About, 12 to 15% are stridently and violently pro-Russian. And on the Ukrainian or the Kiev side, there's about an equal amount. Is that how you see it, that most people are sitting on the fence in the East?
Look, I think it may have begun that way. It certainly is true that in the beginning of the Euromaidan movement, it was largely driven by a fringe of activists who were deeply dissatisfied with the corruption that everyone really resents in Ukraine, but that few people were willing to take concise, public steps to resist. Then it became dominated, or at least the violence was driven by real fringe groups, radical nationalists on one side, and then some pretty scary thuggish forces from the government on the other side. That was the narrative for the first 3 months. I think after Crimea, you had a hardening of positions to a very surprising degree throughout society. I mean, you have a great many people who are not particularly activist people. I mean, they haven't been involved in a lot of causes, but who are quite animated because they see their personal future on the line. It's like friends in Crimea have been telling me over the last month, you know, now very basic questions for them that are linked to their citizenship, like their right to keep their houses or their ability to conduct business and continue to put food on their table for their family. Those things have been implicated. And so it's not surprising that quite different from the traditional perception of post-Soviet apathy, I think people are starting to say, you know, it kind of does matter which direction this region goes, because it might end up, if I'm on the wrong side of it, first of all, I might lose, and it might end up costing me a lot.
Well, isn't that what's going on in Crimea to some extent? Is there some buyer's remorse going on there? Because they were very enthusiastic about the idea of joining Russia and raising their standard of living. But on the other hand, it goes to my question earlier about hegemony as opposed to responsibility. Isn't Putin taking on quite a financial burden there? My understanding is that there's a great deal of uncertainty about property rights and where things stand.
Yeah, Crimea is a complete nightmare right now. I mean, even the official reports from within the Russian government, at least to the extent that they have been made public, indicate very clearly that the Russian Federation's initial plans for integrating Crimea have gone completely off the rails, that they did not have the logistical capacity to hand out 2 million new passports, even assuming that everybody wanted them, and not everybody wants them, and that creates all kinds of complications. What do you do with the de facto reality of having huge numbers of people who want to remain as foreign citizens, but who control, you know, critical assets within a territory that now belongs to a new country? I mean, that is a major problem, and it will result, I think, invariably in a wave of what has been called corporate raiding, where essentially state-backed shadowy forces take over lucrative business assets. That's going to happen. There's going to be a redistribution, and it's already underway, of wealth, and that is going to have a ripple effect because you cannot hide this information, as many Western diplomats have rightly pointed out. In the age of the Internet, people in the East will find that out. People in the West will find that out. But what that will mean is that somebody who is, you know, more positively inclined towards Kiev, towards the European Union, but who lives in Donetsk and owns a business, let's say some kind of, you know, something related to the electrical power infrastructure or something related to communications, that person is going to be pretty certain that if he's caught on the wrong side of the separatist movement, he's going to lose everything.
Well, is that starting to dawn on people in the East, what's happening in Crimea? I mean, I thought from the very beginning, even though obviously the Europeans made this a zero-sum situation, which precipitated this whole crisis, the choices ultimately are between rule of law, an open society, and a kind of gangster form of capitalism.
Well, here's the tricky part of that. It's not a clear-cut choice between good governance and bad, because a lot of the people who are now involved in, not all of them, but a lot of the people who are now involved in the interim government who purport to represent, you know, new forces in Ukraine are in fact old faces. For example, the current governor of Dnipropetrovsk Oblast, which is the second most populous region in Ukraine, very wealthy, industrial, happens also to be in the southeast, is a guy who's known as a major corporate raider from the Yushchenko era, from the post-Orange Revolution, pro-Western period in Ukraine's history. And the same goes to a lesser degree for many other figures in the current government. And so I think plenty of people are understandably cynical when they look at the new forces. I mean, even Petro Poroshenko, right? He says all the right things, but he is still fundamentally an oligarch, right? He's known as the Chocolate King because he owns one of the most successful sweets companies in Ukraine, and he does lots of business in Russia. And he has, I think, conducted a reasonably clean business, but in the Ukrainian context, no one is clean. And people tend to assume that anybody who has significant wealth probably has been in bed with criminal or corrupt forces in order to get it. So I think there's no clarity about what this choice really means. I think there's a geopolitical choice here, which is people with nationalist Ukrainian views would prefer to be associated with Europe than they would with Russia, but that doesn't necessarily carry with it high confidence that there will be an elimination of corruption.
But isn't there also this other factor overriding everything, and that is who is going to take on the bills?
Yes, and it also depends on which bills, because remember, Ukraine essentially owes everybody money for everything. And it starts with the Russians, where you have a multi-billion dollar gas debt, but it runs up through, you know, obviously IMF and other international financial institution loans, Western banks and creditors, and then obviously Ukrainian moguls, you know, Ukrainian oligarchs who have, to a large degree, also financed the activities of government but have profited from them handsomely as well. So I think the question of Ukraine's financial survival is one in which, fundamentally, if Ukraine falls apart, everyone loses, because value, just objectively speaking, value will be lost in that chaos. However, there's a prisoner's dilemma problem here, which is that if Russia's financial leadership, if Russia's big businesses, if the Kremlin believe that they can eke out slightly more profit by pushing Ukraine towards the brink, versus the Western view, which has been basically if we can save and prop up the system, it's better for everyone, I think you could see Ukraine go over the edge.
So when you said earlier, Matthew Rudzinski, about Putin being a couple of steps ahead and thinking strategically, and our side in the West and here in the United States have been flat-footed, my understanding is, to just go to back to the beginning, they were flat-footed on the not being able to detect the Russian military buildup before they grabbed Crimea. Apparently, Secretary of State Kerry has complained about that he'd had no intelligence while he was talking to his Lavrov. He was completely blindsided by what happened. Some people have attributed that to Edward Snowden. I'm not sure what the real story is there. Do you have any information on that?
I don't have any classified information or insider knowledge of how the intelligence side of it works. But what I can tell you is I personally tried very hard for years, but certainly for 1 year, having just come back at that point from 2 months in Ukraine, where I was working with the U.S. Embassy on a fellowship, I tried very hard to push for a strategy towards Ukraine and the Western post-Soviet region, including Belarus and Moldova, which, by the way, are also in play. Many people have mentioned that Transnistria might be next on the chopping block. And the attitude of most senior officials, not only here in Washington, but in Berlin and elsewhere, was, look, there's a European association pathway. If the Ukrainians want to walk down that path, that's the strategy. And you know what? It wasn't enough. We were not thinking long term. We were not thinking about the step beyond the next step. We were not thinking about what happens if the Ukrainians say yes, if they actually go forward with the EU association, and all of a sudden we have created a new geopolitical reality on the ground. Are we prepared to invest in it? Are we prepared to defend it? Are we prepared to accept the reality of Ukraine at that time under Yanukovych? No one was really at a senior government level prepared to have those conversations. And I think, you know, John Kerry's complaint is actually very kind. I mean, narrowing it to a question of did we have particular tactical intelligence at a particular moment, I think this was a strategic failure. This was a failure to think of this region as a region that could potentially matter enormously for American interests.
Well, I think that's borne out by the fact that nobody seemed to have advised the Europeans about making this a zero-sum situation with the Ukrainians vis-a-vis Russia.
I think you're exactly right, Ian. Part of that is the perhaps the lack of experience, or just the institutional poor adaptation of the European Union bureaucracy to conduct a foreign policy. I mean, post-Lisbon, you have the portfolio, belonging to the EU to conduct strategic level foreign policy, and yet you don't actually have a long track record and a competency, and you don't necessarily have the connective tissue between the centers of expertise and knowledge nationally within, say, Germany, within France, the UK, Poland, connecting up to the EU mouthpiece and the EU diplomacy. What you do have, though, I think, is the building blocks of a very sound strategy. The idea that the Ukrainians would take certain reform steps in accordance with this EU association agreement, and that in so doing they would fundamentally transform their society, their economy, and their political system such that they could be compatible with the European Union and the broader West, I think is a very sound strategy. The Europeans also lacked a strategic vocabulary, so they kept describing this, you know, as I say, thoughtful strategy in incredibly shallow bureaucratic terms. You know, follow the rules, check the boxes, and we can take the next step. More for less, blah, blah, blah. They had all these kind of, you know, taglines. And I don't think any of this gave either the Ukrainians themselves, the Russians, or the United States a vision that we could really understand. We were looking to be inspired. We were looking to be reminded why this part of the world matters, why Europe is going to take responsibility for this part of the world. And I think what we got instead was kind of, as I say, you know, almost bureaucratic catchphrases.
But in terms of Kerry versus Lavrov and Obama versus Putin, which is to some extent how we frame things here, and it's also a political year, of course, and you've got John McCain always calling for more testosterone in foreign policy. Are we at a deficit in the sense that what you have in Russia is a new kind of political hybrid that is very, I don't think we've ever seen a situation where you have essentially a combination of organized crime and national security, the mafia and nuclear weapons?
Look, I think we have done no better when it comes to recognizing the potential importance of the U.S.-Russia relationship and thus understanding it in real depth and deploying a thoughtful strategy than we have with respect to Ukraine. The problem when it comes to Russia is, as you say, the stakes are much, much higher. I mean, this is a country that has the capability to destroy the world within an hour's time if they want to, the United States included. And I think the strategic blunder here was to assume in the 1990s that we could rebuild them in our image after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And then when that proved to be a much larger undertaking than we were prepared to invest in, I think collectively the West and the United States in the lead sort of walked off in a huff and said, okay, well, then you take care of yourselves. And, well, they have. And this is what they've come up with. And on the one hand, it is objectively true. Russians live better today than they have at any time in their history. And that's one of the reasons that Mr. Putin remains basically popular. On the other hand, they're still different. They are not living the way that people are in Western Europe. They're not even living the way people are in Central and Eastern Europe, who have now joined the European Union. They're living according to a different set of rules and expectations. And in that context, I think assuming that we can simply, as John Kerry has done, list the reasons why Mr. Putin is being dishonest or is wrong, and put our demands to them and say, come around to our view of the situation in Ukraine or else. You know, and if you agree with us, by the way, then we'll lift the sanctions. That's no way to conduct a negotiation with a country that has lifted itself off of its knees, sees itself as being, you know, one of the great powers in human history and certainly in today's world, and in fact is a superpower when it comes to nuclear issues.
Well, Matthew Rudzinski, I know you're off to Moscow and Kiev, and I'd love to talk to you when you get back, and I appreciate this conversation.
Happy to do so. Thanks a lot, Ian.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Matthew Rudzinski, who's the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. He's an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova, and he's advised governments, intergovernmental organizations on conflict resolution and efforts to enhance shared security throughout the Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian region. Previously, he was deputy director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he founded Carnegie's Ukraine program. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the new rules by the FCC on the future of the internet.
This is a cold war. Do you know what you're fighting for? This is a cold war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sarah Morris, who's a senior policy counsel for the Open Technology Institute at the New America Foundation, where she assists in the research and development of policy proposals related to open technologies, broadband access, and emerging technology issues. Previously, she served as a Google Policy Fellow with the Media Access Project, where her research covered media ownership and the open internet. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Morris.
Thank you, Ian. I'm happy to be here.
And at this point, Chairman of the FCC, Tom Wheel, of course, was absolutely got a blizzard of public input, shall we say, from the last leaks that came in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, which he actually said were dead wrong, but never really refuted the proposals to have a sort of fast track and a slow track on the internet, or fast lanes for content companies that are willing to pay internet service providers for the privilege of getting their product prioritized, or their content prioritized. Now, apparently, these new rules are being circulated today ahead of a vote on Thursday on the proposals. What's your understanding of what Wheeler is now promising?
Well, and keep in mind that these are just proposed rules, so they'll be released on Thursday for public comment if they're voted out of the commission by a majority of the commissioners. So there's still a long road ahead of us. But where we've come and gone in the past few days, I think, is certainly a more consideration of two sort of major legal paths that the commission could take. The one that the chairman has been sort of focused on for the past few weeks has been this what we call a title, or 706 approach, Section 706 of the Communications Act, which is the same authority that the Commission relied on in its most recent open internet rules from 2010 that were thrown out last January by the D.C. Circuit. So what we're seeing in the new draft is still a focus on that legal authority, which to advocates for strong net neutrality protections, that's what we believe to be the wrong source of authority going forward. And so what we're hoping to see in the new NPRM is more focus on an alternative legal path so that we can implement much stronger rules going forward.
Now, that alternative path has been suggested in other court cases, including the Verizon court case before the Second Circuit, wasn't it?
It wasn't the primary basis on which the FCC relied for authority. Section 706 was the basis of authority there. But the issue of what we call reclassification, which is to treat broadband service as a common carriage service, that has been debated for nearly a decade, or over a decade.
And the reason we don't have that is because of a decision made earlier by the former chair, Michael Powell.
Correct.
So, in other words, what advocates of preserving net neutrality are saying is that you've got to go back to pre-Michael Powell and treat the internet as a public utility.
That's correct, and that's essentially what the D.C. Circuit court case said in its opinion in January, was that you've done all the right rules. These rules are good. They address a problem that you've articulated. The only problem is that in order to impose them on what they call non-common carriers, that would be an impermissible application of your authority. You can only apply those rules to service providers that are in the common carriage bucket, so to speak.
So then, is Tom Wheeler trying to thread the needle here between what most people want, at least those in terms of the activists who have been lobbying pretty hard since the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times came out with these leaks about a two-tiered internet, which alarms a lot of people? So is he trying to thread the needle in essentially in an impossible way?
That's what we believe. I mean, and it's not just activists. We've had letters from over 100 companies, venture capitalists, and the like go into the FCC in the past week, all calling for rules that don't allow for paid prioritization, the types of deals that you described. At the Open Technology Institute, where I work, we, along with many other advocates, strongly believe that the only way to achieve net neutrality protections that protect against paid prioritization is through a Title II approach. Trying to work them in under a 706 approach won't result in the types of rules that we want to see.
And it does seem that Senator Al Franken is the strongest proponent, at least on Capitol Hill, of taking this new approach of basically reclassifying it as a utility?
Senator Franken has been a fantastic supporter. He was joined with, I think, 9 or 10 other senators this week in a letter to the FCC, including Elizabeth Warren and others. So there's definitely a growing base of support for a different approach than what the commission seems to be taking.
So where are the votes then? Can you divine that, Sarah, in terms of you've got, what, 3 Democrats, including the chair, and you've got 2 Republicans, right?
Right. And, you know, it's hard to predict where all of the different votes will fall. I would reiterate that this is a pretty, like, introductory vote. So this isn't the final vote on the rules. This is just sort of voting to open the rules up for public comment. And then several months down the road would be the final vote on the rules after all of the public and advocacy groups have had a chance to weigh in. So, you know, it's not as though the vote would have to be voting certain rules into effect, but rather just opening the door for the rules to be then open for public comment.
Again, I'm speaking with Sarah Morris, who's a senior policy counsel for the Open Technology Institute at the New America Foundation, where she assists in the research and development of policy proposals related to open technologies, broadband access, and emerging technology issues. Previously, she served as a Google Policy Fellow with the Media Access Project, where her research covered media ownership and the open internet. So do we know then that the really biting the bullet here, which is to reclassify the internet as a utility, is that on the agenda?
We're hearing reports that it is included in the rulemaking proposal. How much attention it receives in the rulemaking proposal is an open question. And even then, we still have, I think, a lot of work to be done to move the commission on a path towards reclassification.
And what's your sense then of the notion that the FCC chairman, Tom Wheeler, has sort of bent with the blizzard of input from you and other activists and those on the gathering storm on Capitol Hill, if you will, led by Senator Al Franken?
Well, I think he's clearly recognizing that blizzard and responding to it and taking all of that into account. And I think that we're continuing to move forward a strong momentum towards the right path. It's just we're not quite there yet. And I think that this, as this proceeding unfolds, there will be a lot more need for public comment, for continued advocacy efforts, for continued grassroots efforts and activism throughout the summer and beyond.
But on the other side, the status quo is what the powerful telecom and cable lobby are pushing, right? Going back to Michael Powell setting this course for them, which will allow the gradual erosion of net neutrality. And that would seem to be, I mean, Michael Powell, of course, is now the head of the lobbying arm of the telecom and cable oligopolies, is he not?
That's true.
And Wheeler was the previous head, right? The same one.
Yes, that is also true.
So you essentially have a situation now where the Comcasts and the Time Warners, et cetera, the Verizons, they're at least happy with the status quo, albeit they want more.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the chairman, Chairman Wheeler, does really want to do the right thing here. And while we may disagree on the specifics, I think he's being receptive and responsive. But you're right, there is a tremendous amount of political pressure from the other side, from the carriers and others who would prefer for the protections to sort of just go away. And so it will be an uphill battle for sure, but one that I think that many different groups and organizations and companies are aligned on.
Well, how much do you think the argument has been made that if we hand over the internet to the big oligopolies like Time Warner and Comcast, who may well merge as one, that you'll end up with an internet that's as bad as what you have in terms of cable television?
I think that the cableization of the internet is a very real concern, and you know, it probably would not happen overnight, but we have definitely seen the willingness and indeed attempts by different internet service providers to control how we access content online. And so the need for net neutrality protections has not gone away. It's very much still a very real threat and something that we were very concerned about.
And in terms of the alternative, at least some people have put forth this idea that you can do an end run around the FCC and the cable and telecom oligopolies via municipal broadband. And there was a report recently that Chairman Wheeler, in fact, I think in a speech that he made before this very cable lobby, said that he would work vigorously to undo lawsuits that these Verizons and Comcasts have preemptively sued a number of municipalities and states to prevent them from having their own municipal broadband services.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that municipal broadband networks have a huge role to play in both, in not just providing access that's free of discrimination or blocking online, but also to provide service to communities where, for rate of return reasons or whatever, the traditional carrier model has not served in an adequate way. And so there's, you know, in the great ecosystem of broadband delivery and internet infrastructure, there's a tremendous value in having municipalities available as an option for communities.
And that's another way of saying that the U.S. is slipping behind, right?
Oh, that's correct. We released a report earlier this year that said demonstrated that when compared with our global peers, cities in the U.S. have higher prices and lower service quality than those other cities around the world.
And conversely, cities like Chattanooga, Tennessee, and Santa Monica, California, that have put in the fiber optics and made this service available, it's been a huge boon for business.
That's right. There have been cities with municipal broadband networks that prove to be like bright spots in that otherwise gloomy picture that I just described.
So would you then suggest that these two paths are not mutually exclusive? In other words, people should both lobby hard to preserve net neutrality and at the same time lobby hard for municipal broadband?
That's right. I mean, even with a radical expansion of municipal broadband networks across the country, many people still rely, in fact, the vast majority of people still rely on broadband service from a private carrier. And the need for net neutrality protections sort of transcends competition concerns, although we think that the competition concerns are also tremendously important. But these are the types of protections that are needed even in an area, for places where there are multiple broadband options.
And previously you served as a Google policy fellow with the Media Access Project. My understanding is that Google has laid fiber optics in a couple of cities around the United States. Do you know how much further they want to take that?
Well, I will say that my Google Policy Fellowships was just a program that Google sort of sponsors for policy advocates in the public interest and space. And so I didn't actually work for Google or anything like that. But yes, I think Google has been pretty clear in its desire to expand the Google Fiber platform and to do those deployments in more cities across the country, and we'll start to see that unfold in the coming months, I think.
Do you know what their strategy is?
My understanding is that they're doing sort of city or metropolitan area-wide analysis and community research in a variety of cities across the country. And once they've conducted that research and worked with communities to determine, you know, what their needs are, then they'll move to, hopefully, from their perspective, to actually deploying Google Fiber in those cities.
Well, I don't know whether you know this, Sarah, but there is today is the annual shareholders meeting of Google, and there's a number of protesters outside and inside the shareholders meeting complaining about Google not being transparent about its lobbying money and its membership in the American Chamber of Commerce and ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. So Google's getting some heat.
It appears so.
So anyway, back to the purpose of this conversation, just to wrap it up. What's your sense then, Sarah? We will, of course, know on Thursday how the FCC votes on these new rules, and they will be available for public comment. And that's, I guess, when people will start really weighing in. Do you think that it is possible to thread the needle, as the chairman appears to be, or do you think there'll be sufficient critical mass here to force him to realize that the only really way to protect net neutrality is to reclassify the internet as a utility?
I think that there is tremendous momentum for the latter, towards reclassification, and I think that it will be necessary to continue that momentum, not just through this Thursday, but through the coming months. And so there is still work to be done, but the chairman does seem to be listening to the concerns that have been expressed by these wide-ranging constituencies, and we'll just have to see where that ends up.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Sarah Morris.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Sarah Morris, who's a senior policy counsel for the Open Technology Institute at the New America Foundation, where she assists in the research and development of policy proposals related to open technologies, broadband access, and emerging technological issues. Previously, she served as a Google Policy Fellow with the Media Access Project, where her research covered media ownership and the open internet. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into demonstrations taking place today at Google's annual shareholders meeting. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Brant Olson, who's the campaign director at Forecast the Facts, a grassroots community organization devoted to ensuring Americans receive accurate information about climate change. He joins us from a demonstration at Google's annual shareholders meeting, where he and other groups are calling on Google to disclose how much it is spending on lobbying, to leave the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and ALEC, and to treat workers and communities with respect. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brant Olson.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
And first of all, why are we demonstrating, and you and other groups demonstrating in front of Google's shareholders' annual meeting when the company's motto is "Don't be evil"? What is evil about Google?
Well, Google has really taken a turn for the worse. Despite what they say, which is that they are a big supporter of things like clean energy and solar power in particular, they have been affiliating themselves with the American Legislative Exchange Council and the Chamber of Commerce, which are two of the nation's largest opponents to renewable energy and to solar in particular. So we're going to be there with Steve Wilt, who is an owner of a solar company in Oklahoma, who actually has been, you know, impacted pretty badly because of a policy that ALEC was backing that essentially imposes a tax on his customers. So confronting Google's executive leadership in person, letting them know that their choices to affiliate with ALEC are really having some consequences in terms of people's business and our ability to support clean energy.
And along with you and your organization, I understand Walden Asset Management are going to be putting forth a resolution in the actual shareholders' meeting asking for Google to reveal a lot of its activities in terms of federal and state lobbying and what tax-exempt associations, I imagine that's those 501c4s that Google is a member of and how much it spends. What's your sense of how that's going to be received?
Well, frankly, it's probably not going to be received by Google very well. I mean, over half of the shares in the company are owned by the founders, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, as well as other top executives at the company, and they have already made very clear that they're not interested in this kind of disclosure. But it's really not about that. I mean, this is really about continuing to apply the kind of pressure on Google that we feel is going to be needed to have the company come back, to the side of good and really put their money where their mouth is in terms of support for clean energy.
But in terms of them as a corporation, what are they doing about clean energy? What's their how green are these? Is Google?
Well, it's really our assessment is that it's a bit of a left hand right hand issue. On the right hand, you have Google as one of the largest underwriters of rooftop solar in the country. They have poured more than $300 million into funds that are providing solar leases to homeowners, many of them in California, but also across the country. But on the right hand, you have their government advocacy efforts, which include this membership in the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is really single-handedly and, well, together with their partners at the Chamber of Commerce, working to undermine rooftop solar in states across the country. There's provisions in more than 10 states that are now pending to impose taxes on people who choose to put solar panels on their roof and sell electricity back to the grid. That is a provision that is really going to damage the national market for solar. And so we're sort of staging an intervention here, telling Google that they need to pay attention to what they're doing across the organization and pull their support from ALEC, because it's really impinging on the good work that they're doing on the other side to promote rooftop solar.
Again, I'm speaking with Brad Olson, who's the campaign director at Forecast the Facts, a grassroots community organization devoted to ensuring Americans receive accurate information about climate change. He joins us from a demonstration at Google's annual shareholders meeting, where he and other groups are calling on Google to disclose how much it spends on lobbying to leave the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and to treat workers and communities with respect. Now, on the last point there, is there evidence that Google don't treat workers and communities with respect?
Well, we are aligned with a number of groups that are out at the Google shareholder meeting, including Common Cause, Public Citizen, and others who are wanting Google to come clean about all of the places that it's pushing its money around to make sure that it's accountable for those types of actions, and that includes money to places like San Francisco, where there's been a lot of criticism of Google for taking over public infrastructure by using bus stops for its commuter buses and things of that nature. So we feel that all of these issues are important for Google to disclose in terms of their financial interests, and that's why we've really been linked together in this call for more transparency from Google.
Well, as you know, I'm sure, Brad Olson, net neutrality is a huge issue, and Google is an important player in the net neutrality debate. What's your understanding about what Google is doing in terms of doing an end run around if net neutrality is destroyed? The alternative will be municipal broadband. And my understanding is that Google is actually laying down broadband in some cities around the country. What's your understanding about this company that whose motto is "Don't be evil"? What are their intentions in that regard? Are they on the side of the angels?
Well, that's not an issue, unfortunately, that I can speak with a lot of authority on. I mean, all that I would say is that whatever the issue is, I think it's important across the corporate world, but at Google in particular, given its size and influence, that there's transparency around where its money is going and where it's looking to curry favor with decision makers that should be held accountable to the electorate as opposed to corporate money. And so Google is a very large corporate donor to political campaigns, to lobbying activity. The extent to which we can get a peek inside where all of that money is going, the better, whether it's net neutrality, rooftop solar, or use of public infrastructure here in the Bay Area.
But isn't it possible, though, to be a green company and to also be an evil company? I mean, the president just recently showed up at Walmart, of all places, and we know how Walmart doesn't pay its workers sufficiently so that they and doesn't give them health care coverage and a living wage, and essentially dumps them on the public dime. And at the same time, the president regaled them with his presence about how they're going green around the world, and they're the biggest employer in the United States, the biggest private employer in the United States, and also News Corporation, headed by Rupert Murdoch, that runs Fox News and has a very toxic effect on our politics in this country. His company is also gone green.
Right, and you have Fox News on the one hand, you know, featuring people who are questioning the basic science of climate change during prime time, and on the other hand, you have the Fox networks hosting Cosmos, which is actually unpacking and debunking those types of conspiracy theories. So, yeah, I mean, corporations and Google in particular. I mean, Google is one of the largest companies in the world, so certainly there are positive aspects of their business. Again, one of the largest underwriter of rooftop solar in the country, probably in the world. That's absolutely something that we back and need to see more of in order to, you know, turn the corner on solutions for climate change. But on the other hand, it's pushing money into a lot of dark places that it's not really being held accountable for. And so our message is that more transparency, you know, will breed better behavior. Sunlight is the best disinfectant, as they say. So I think the important thing is that we understand where Google is putting money and making sure that what it says and what it does are lining up.
And what is your understanding of Google's relationship with the Obama White House? Eric Schmidt has had various positions there, I think, or at least he certainly spent a lot of time at the White House.
Yeah, well, there's long history there. Google historically has been a major financier of the Democratic Party and of President Obama in particular. In the last several years, we've seen an intentional shift, I think, by Google to curry more favor with GOP politicians. And that's a strategic play. They think that playing both sides of the field in Washington is going to allow them to have more influence in the long run. Our message to Google is that, you know, at the end of the day, it needs to be accountable to its customers, to its investors, and to what it says that it is interested in, which is promoting, a stronger policy on renewable energy. But I think that, you know, the assumption that we would question is whether you can be a strong advocate for renewable energy at the same time as providing funds to avowed enemies of renewable energy, even if you may be aligned with them on other issues.
So why do you think that they joined ALEC? When did they join ALEC?
They joined ALEC within the last year. And as to why, you know, Google has still not been on the record as to why they are members of ALEC. Some have speculated that Google is aligned with ALEC for the same reason that other tech companies have aligned with them, which has to do with user liability issues, essentially raising the bar on what it would take to sue a company like Google for libelous posts, say, that wind up on their social network. But that's all speculation, because Google hasn't really chosen to go on the record as to why they're affiliated with ALEC, so we don't know, really. I think that what we're saying, Steve, the business owner that I mentioned from Oklahoma, who is facing a very uncertain future as a result of a policy that was backed by ALEC on rooftop solar, our message is that Google shouldn't be aligning itself with these types of interests, even if it, you know, may have, even if it may be aligned on something, you know, tangential.
So could Google's membership in ALEC be a part of its sort of hedging its bets, having invested in the Democrats and in the White House? They want to spread their money around Washington a little more?
Yeah, that's absolutely it. And I mean, what I haven't talked about, but which is, you know, certainly at play here, is the fact that, you know, this is a strategy that only makes sense post Citizens United. we have unlimited corporate contributions that are now flowing into our political system. And only in that type of environment does it make sense to play both sides of the field and think, well, we are just going to flood the zone with as much money as we possibly can so that at the end of the day, it's our interests that are going to be at the front of the line. That's a real sorry state of affairs and one that, you know, absolutely needs to be addressed. So we are supportive of a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United, as well as the more recent McCutcheon decision, which allows for unlimited contributions to 501c4. That allows unlimited contributions to members of Congress, even those that are disclosed. So less corporate money in our political system, we think, is a good thing. In the meantime, we're going to be pushing Google to disclose where that money's going.
And in terms of the broader political environment up there in Silicon Valley, my understanding is that while you do have companies like Google that have given money to the Democrats, you also have a strong streak of libertarianism up there, don't you?
You do. And, I think that may be what's behind some of this corporate giving as well, you know, to say that essentially the market will solve all problems. And we're going to be lobbying hard to reduce regulations as much as we can. But I don't know. I don't know that I would want to ascribe that philosophy to what Google has been doing. They have been very intentional about where they're putting their money, and I think it has mostly to do with, as you might imagine, protecting their core business. But at the same time, they have been a very vocal supporter of clean energy. They've been they've been putting a lot of money into it, even if it's relatively little for Google. I mean, $300 million for Google is something of a drop in the bucket compared to their overall market capitalization. But it makes Google a major player in the market overall. So, you know, to the extent that libertarian ideology is sort of steering some of these decisions, we would say. Really, the important issue here is that that we get some disclosure. We shouldn't be relying on Google just to say trust us in terms of where it's putting its money and where it's putting its influence in Washington.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Brant Olson.
Thank you. Good being with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Brant Olson, who's a campaign director at Forecast the Facts, a grassroots community organization devoted to ensuring Americans receive accurate information about climate change. He joins us from a demonstration at Google's annual shareholders meeting, where he and other groups are calling on Google to disclose how much it spends on lobbying, to leave the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and to treat workers and communities with respect. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.